I'm delighted to be here today. I want us to have a good time, so I want you to get comfortable because we're going to exercise a lot. How many of you like to exercise? I don't either, as you can tell. I ride my bike down to the donut shop every morning. I think I'll take my shoes off because it'll make the mic a little easier so I don't have to stretch myself. She said something about living between estrogen and death. Someone said I should say I'm living between the Blue Lagoon and Golden Pond. But I want you to laugh a lot this morning, and I want you to exercise, because exercise is like jogging on the inside. So if you laugh a lot, someone told me they heard my story and they laughed 85 times. That's fabulous. So when you go out of here, you should be exhausted from laughing. Because you see, pain is inevitable, but misery is optional. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We are all going to have pain. There's no way that you're going to get through life without pain. But it's up to you to decide how you're going to react to it, and misery is optional. And I have to mention about this book, Fresh Elastic for Stretched Out Moms. Probably some of you listen to Jim McClellan on Channel 40, and he talks fast, and I talk fast, and the more excited we are, the faster we talk, and he's saying, get this book, Fresh Elastic for Stretched Out Moms, and I'm saying, oh yeah, Fresh Elastic, and we're just talking so fast, and when we got done, I said, Jim, we talk so fast, nobody understood us. He said, oh, they'll get it, Barbara, they'll get it. Then he called me in a couple of days, and he said, they didn't get it, Barbara. He said, I had one lady call me, and she says, I want to get that book you advertised, and I think the name of it was Prophylactics for Stretched Out Moms. So we knew she didn't get it. But I think laughing is such a good exercise, and I think the joy of the Lord, see, having God living in the marrow bones of what joy is all about. And so we're going to talk about joy today. I think one of the best exercises you can do is called rapture practice. You go out in the backyard and jump up and down and practice for the rapture. And there's a new group out now called Toot and Scoot. He's going to toot and we're going to scoot. So I'm going to tell you today my story, which is, where does a mother go to resign? And there is no place, girls. You're in it. It's like, once you have a child, it's like getting a life sentence in prison with no hope of parole. I heard Chuck Swindoll say the other day that you spend the first 3 years teaching a kid to walk and talk, and the next 15 years teaching them to sit down and shut up. Now, on the back of this book, this is what the publisher put. I didn't put this. My title was mine, because where do you go to resign? But this is what they put, and it's so bad, I don't know how they ever sell the book. It says, this is the true story of a wife and mother who learned how to cope with the crippling of her husband, the death of two sons, and the homosexuality of a third. I mean, what a downer. Who would buy that book? But anyway, that's what they put. But when the book first came out was when we had those long gas lines in California. Well, I'm in California, but when we had those long gas lines here, and you had to wait a long time to get gas, and you had to be, you know, odd or even or something. And I was odd. And you know, after you see you're going to wait an hour, and you clean your purse, and you study your driver's license, and there's nothing else to do. And my book had just come out, and I had one copy in the back seat to give to the man who did the introduction. And so I thought, well, you know, what am I going to do so long? I'll read my own book. So I reached around to the back seat, and I undid this book, and I started to read. And I got in about two chapters, and I thought, you know, wow, I wonder how this lady comes out. And then at one place, I was going to underline, because I thought, oh, this is so good, I want to remember this. And then I realized that God plucked me out of all this misery and all this pain, and I can hardly believe it's my story. In fact, when I know I'm going to go out and share my story, I kind of flip through here to make sure that what I say is kind of close to the book. So, because, you know, sanguines have a tendency to exaggerate and lie a lot, and I at least want the book to go along a little with what I'm going to tell you. I'm going to tell you, we had a series of four experiences in our family, four traumas that happened in a period of 9 years, any one of which would probably sink Molly Brown, but God has brought me through with a lot of joy and a lot of energy. Now, you can laugh any time in this story. There's no proper time to laugh or cry. You can laugh or cry, and don't feel embarrassed if you think you're laughing at the wrong time or crying at the wrong time. That's okay. I'm used to that. I'm used to that, and there's a lot of emotion in it, so I want you to share it. And some of you have got a lot of pain, and today we're going to help you drain some of those abscesses, so if you can relive with me some of the experiences I've had and see how God has brought me through. 1966, my husband and I, we had four sons, and we were going to go up to San Gabriel Canyon to a retreat and take our kids from our church up there for an Easter week, and we were going to be chaperones. He went on ahead of me that night and took things like, you know, popcorn and caramel corn and all the fun stuff, and I came behind him a half an hour with the kids. Now, the road had not been used a lot. There was a lot of debris in the road. That first time the road had been opened up for anyone to use it. And as I came up about 10 miles this side of our destination, I found this heap of a man lying in the middle of the road, all covered with glass, and no way I could recognize him. Blood all over, a big purplish mass on the outside of his head, which I learned later was part of his brain was exposed. And there's no way that I knew it was him except by his clothes. And I had to leave him there in the road because I was the first of a caravan of cars coming, leave one of the children with him so no one would run over him, and go up 10 miles to get to a telephone to get an ambulance to take him down to the hospital. I won't go into all the details because it's in the book, and hopefully some of you may buy the book. But it was 2 days later, a neurosurgeon and another specialist came out and talked to me and said that he would be blind and he never would know anybody again. He would be a vegetable for life, and that I would have to make arrangements for him to be put in Sawtelle Veterans Hospital. He had been a lieutenant commander in the Navy, so he would qualify for care. I mean, wow, 2 days before we had a nice family, four nice Christian kids, two dogs and a cat, a nice home, a swimming pool, and he was had a good job, and all of a sudden I'm trying to get him into the Veterans Hospital to live. I started out by going to get him a white cane. I knew how to do that, so I went and got him a white cane, Aid for the Blind. Then I started going to the places like the Veterans Pension, Aid of the Blind, Disability, Social Security, and getting all these programs. And then they paid off our house. The veteran said he was unrehabilitatable, so they paid off our house. That was great. And they paid us $10,000 for each eye because he was blind. We had that. And just as I had gotten on all these programs, it's not easy to get on all these, Social Security, Aid the Blind, Veterans Pension, Disability, Food Stamps, boy, I had it all. Just as I got on everything, the Lord healed him. And you know... I don't know why he couldn't heal him before I got on all those programs. Because it's not easy to get on, and it's not easy to get off those programs. And then I thought, what if I have to give back that, you know, the $10,000 which I'd already spent, you know? And then they paid off our house, and what am I gonna do about that? It was just so much. But we had to take him out on Wilshire Boulevard to the Veterans Administration. You just don't call him up and say, I'm going back to work, I've been healed, you know? And so we had to take him out there and be examined by a group of doctors. And they said, well, we examined this man, and we said that he's totally unrehabilitatable. I mean, you just don't come and tell us he's going back to work. But we did. Our doctor was a Christian. He said God had miraculously worked, and he was going back to work as an engineer. And here I'm trying to get off all these programs. And they said we could keep the money. It was just too confusing for them, so just keep the money. But, you know, now he wanted to get a driver's license back. And once you've had seizures and brain damage and been blind, the Department of Motor Vehicles, they're not real quick to give you back your license, see? So we're having a lot of trouble going around with the DMV. See, nobody wanted to give him a road test. You can figure that out. And so that was one of the most frustrating things, was trying to get him to get a license. It was 2 years we went through them, and then a real miracle happened. Up in Sacramento somehow, they either had a fire or someone, they lost his records. And so then he started out all fresh and new, and nobody knew his problem, so now he drives, you know. But I'd stay off Lambert Road, but anyway... No, but God has done a miracle. So 2 years were going by. He still wasn't driving. I was taking him back and forth to Whittier to work because he was an engineer, but he couldn't persuade the DMV to give him a license. And we had an 18-year-old son. His name was Stephen, a beautiful Christian boy. And he wanted to go in the Marines. And that was in 1968 when we thought the Vietnam thing was all slowing down and decelerating. So I went and signed the papers just before his 18th birthday that he could go into the Marines. And he went in. He was only in very few months, and he was sent over to Vietnam. And his letters reflected a depth of spiritual growth that we hadn't seen at home. But we knew that he loved the Lord. And on the 28th of July, we had a Marine car drive up in front of our house and say that he and all of his buddies had been wiped out. 10 days went by, and we were getting ready to have a service for him, and I got a call from a little mortuary up in Glendora, and they said, Mrs. Johnson, you'll have to come up here and identify Stephen's body, because when you're killed in a foreign country, the next of kin has to identify the body. Well, my husband wasn't even driving a car yet, and I remember it was a hot day in August, and so I went up there to this mortuary by myself. And because he had laid face down 3 days in a rice paddy, all bloated and swollen, I went in this mortuary, and they showed me this boy in this hermetically sealed box. They only show you the top half, so I don't even know if there's anything beneath the waist. Brown, bloated, and swollen boy. And I looked at them, and the man told me this: I have to sign the paper that goes with this box. And there's no way that looked like the boy that I had known for 18 years. No way. I mean, all the swelling and the brown. He looked like he was Mongolian. No way did he look like a white boy. But because the man said that this boy belongs in the box, I signed the paper. And when I went out that day, I remember I thought, oh, wow, we've had the cup of suffering now. My husband has been restored. He's still a little strange. But he's an only child, and they're all a little different. But I said, we've been through that, and you've worked in his life, and now we've lost one beautiful deposit in heaven. So we have a beautiful deposit in heaven. And I thank the Lord that he was a Christian, that he knew the Lord. We began working with parents who lost children in Vietnam. At that time, there was many lists of the paper every day in the Times of boys who were killed. And we had a little brochure printed up called Safe in the Arms of Jesus. Had his picture on the front, a letter that he had written home, and the four spiritual laws on the back. And we would share that with other parents who had lost children in Vietnam. That was a nucleus of our working with parents who had been through crisis situations. Now, I'm taking ahead. That was 1968 to 1973. And this is our oldest son. His name was Tim. Beautiful, handsome boy, 23 years old. He graduated from the Los Angeles Police Academy, and then he took a trip up to Alaska with a friend of his. Now, I must tell you about Tim. He was not a fun, bubbly, he was boring is what he was, I thought, compared to the rest of the family. But anyway, he worked at Rose Hills Mortuary. It tells you something. And his idea of fun was when they had extra flowers and bows at the mortuary, he would bring them home and put them on the dogs and the cat. So when I came home, the dog had a big bow that said, "May he rest in peace." Well, that was Tim's idea of fun. So he was not a fun kid. He was boring, and he was conservative, and he was dull. But he went up to Alaska. Well, while he was up there, he went to a place called Abbot Chapel, and he noticed that he had the baptism of the Holy Spirit. Wow, you know, we didn't know much about that. We didn't believe in that. We called one of our elders from our church over, and they said, "Well, wait till he gets home, and we'll straighten him out." And so from his letters, we knew that God had indeed touched his life. Now, he called me on the 1st of August of 1973, and I like a new month. I think a new month. Now, yesterday or whenever it was 2 days ago, I think a new month is fabulous, and I wash my hair and change the sheets and take a bath, and I do a lot of exciting things because other times, too. But always on a new month, I think it's wonderful to tear off that calendar, and I have a whole new month. I haven't even messed it up or done anything wrong or anything. It's a whole new month. And that way I get to have a lot more holidays. So he called me collect on the 1st of August, and he said, "I just want to know what you're doing to celebrate a new month." And I said, "Well, I'm just waiting for a collect call from you." And he said, "Well, Ron and I are on our way home. We're up in the White Horse, Yukon." And he says, "I just can't believe how excited and happy I am because I've got a sparkle in my eye and a spring in my step. And I'll be home in five days to tell you what God's done in my life." I mean, what has God done? I mean, I don't understand this. You're a Christian boy. I mean, he went to Campus Crusade and Basic Youth. I had to pay him to go, but he went. And I remember buying him a set of tires once to get him to go to a youth convention. But he went to everything, but he just never seemed to enjoy it. But he went. And so now he's telling him he's got a sparkle in his eye and a spring in his step, and he'll be home in 5 days. And I was thrilled. And he said something about, "Why don't you and Dad get out of that boring church you go to and go to," and he mentioned a couple others. I said, "Oh, we never would go there. They swing from the chandeliers there, you know." And so we were talking, and I just enjoying thinking he's going to be home in 5 days, and I'm going to find out what has happened to turn this boring, conservative kid into such a sparkling, happy boy. I even called my sister in Minnesota because he had spent one summer there, and she knew he was dull, too. And so I was sitting down at supper time a couple hours after the phone call, and I was cheering with my husband and my two other sons how excited that Tim was going to be home in 5 days, and he's going to tell us whatever this wonderful thing has happened in his life. And just then the phone rang, and it was the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. And they said that his little Volkswagen, if you can see it later, his little Volkswagen had been hit by a 3-ton truck with some drunk boys in it. And he and his friend were ushered immediately into the presence of God. now this isn't fair. And I remember saying, this is not fair. I mean, how am I going to know his story? It's not fair. How could this happen? He told us he's coming home. I just talked to him a few hours ago. He's going to be home to share. How am I ever going to know what's happened in his life? And I've got one deposit in heaven. I don't need another deposit in heaven. And I flailed at God that it is not fair. Why us? Why my family? And just about that time, I got a call from this church up in Alaska. And they said, we're not going to let those two boys' story die in the Yukon. We want to come down and share what God really did in their lives. Well, this was exciting because I wanted to know what had changed these boys' lives. And so as we're getting ready to have a service for them, another few days going by, the pictures were in the San Gabriel Tribune, two beautiful boys that were killed on the Yukon Highway. Evidently, Tim had sat down the day before he started home and written letters to a lot of girls he used to go with. And they were coming over with these letters, and he was not as dull as I thought he was. Because they were coming over with these letters saying, please forgive me for being a creep. Every mother wondered what all that was. And telling them that God had done something so wonderful in his life and how excited and happy he was. And there were several girls coming over with these beautiful letters. Now you can imagine the shock of reading in the paper, seeing a picture of a beautiful boy that has been killed, and the next day you get a long flowing letter asking forgiveness for whatever. And so these girls were coming, and we could see the fragrance was coming from his life, even though body hadn't even got here yet, but we could see that God was going to use that story in a special way. So we were getting ready to have a service. The other boys' parents weren't Christians, but they came to know the Lord the next day after this all happened. And I got a call from this same little mortuary man up in Glendora after 10 days went by. And he said, Mrs. Johnson, I never had to do this before. But you know, the law is that if someone's killed in a foreign country, you'll have to come up and identify Tim's body. Now, this is 5 years to the day that I had been there with Stephen. A hot day in August of 1973. And I'd been there in 1968 on a hot day in August. And he said, you'll have to come up and identify Tim's body because he was killed in the Yukon. Well, I didn't know where the Yukon was. My geography is terrible anyway. But the Yukon, I thought of Sergeant Preston and some sled dogs somewhere. But the Yukon is Canada, and it's a foreign country. My husband was driving a car by now, but I went by myself since I had gone before alone. I went up there on this hot day in August. And by myself, and I went in there, and I thought, I can't believe this is happening to me. I mean, am I going to be coming up here every 5 years looking at another boy in a box? And I went in this room, and I thought, this is the same dumb carpeting they had 5 years ago. It's the same dumb wallpaper they had 5 years ago, and this same little man standing there telling me I'm looking at another boy in a box. I mean, I can't believe this is happening, but it was happening. And so as I stood there and I looked at what they set down, and because you're in the front seat of a Volkswagen hit by a 310 truck, there's not a lot left to look at. But I looked at what they told me was my son, the remnants, and I signed the paper that this boy belongs with this box. And when I went out that day, God did something so special for me. I've never had it happen before or since. I've never needed it as much before or since. But as I looked up, and they're always mowing the lawn in that mortuary, and you can always hear the crows. And as I looked up, I saw this boy's face, and he was all smiling, and around him was gold and shining and bright. And he was saying, don't cry, Mom, because I'm not there. I'm rejoicing around the throne of God. And it was just like God wrapped me in that special blanket to remind me that he did love me. And that when I was saying, why me, I had to learn to say, whatever, Lord, because whatever he sends into your life, his filter's large enough to accommodate it. We had a wonderful service for him and for his friend at our church, and we learned about the Holy Baptism, Holy Spirit. The people came down from Alaska and shared. It was just like opening up a new door and fresh air into some of our understanding that we didn't understand a lot about that. And so we were now working with parents who had lost children in death because we had two deposits in heaven. Several months went by, and it was getting towards Christmas time. Now, some of you know that Christmas can be the pits if you lost a loved one. It can be the pits if you haven't lost a loved one. Christmas can be, we think it's going to be like, you know, Courier and Ives, and sometimes it's more like As the World Turns. So we're getting ready for Christmas, and I was thinking, two empty chairs at the table, oh, it's going to be very hard, two empty chairs, it's going to be a lonely Christmas. And I knew that at that church where he had been, that he'd given his testimony and been baptized. It kind of hurt my feelings he got baptized, because we had good water at our church. But anyway, but he got baptized up there. He told us that. And so my husband and I went up to Alaska and asked if we could, we did other things, but we asked if we could have a copy of the tape the night that he was baptized. And they said, well, we're so sorry, but the night he was baptized, they didn't tape it. Oh, they got thousands of tapes, and they didn't tape it. And well, why didn't they tape it? Because the man who did the taping, he was baptized. Well, it seemed like somebody could be smart enough to push the button to tape the tape. So I came back feeling, well, see, that's not fair. I'm only asking for one little dumb tape, and they didn't tape it. It just messed up it. So this before Christmas, in the mail, came a beat-up, chipped-up, emerald-colored tape. Had my address on it, no return address, just to me. And I had no idea what it was because the church hadn't taped it. So I put it on my machine and started out, "Hi, I'm Tim Johnson. I'm from California. I want to tell you what the Lord's done in my life." And then he went on and told what the Lord's done in his life. And at the end he said, "Wow, I don't know. I must have been a sour lemon before." Oh, boy, that's for sure. And then you heard the water splashing and splashing. You heard him being baptized. And then you heard this boy say, "Praise the Lord." I had never heard this kid sound excited about anything. And here he's saying, "Praise the Lord," in front of all these people. And the other side was the other boy. And he said, "My name is Ron. I'm up here from California with Tim. My parents aren't Christians. My dad's an alcoholic. And we're excited to go home and share with my parents what God's done in our life." And then you hear him being baptized. You see how beautiful that God sent that tape to us just before Christmas. And the story was, it was not taped at the church. But one man had been a fisherman from Nome, Alaska. He'd been visiting the church, and he taped it and then took it back to Nome, Alaska, the end of the world. And one of these bush pilots that flies around the little villages let it be known they were trying to find the tape, if anybody had taped it that night. And he sent it directly to me. Instead of sending it to the church, he sent it to me. If he'd sent it to the church, I wouldn't have got it till Groundhog Day probably, but as it was, I got it for Christmas. You see, God's timing and God's economy is so fabulous. And so that's another way that God sends a sparkle into our life, and God wraps us in that comfort blanket to remind us of how much He loves us and how important we are to Him. So that was in December of 1973. Now we had two sons left. We're working now with parents. One son is named Barney, and he goes to Calvary Chapel in West Covina. I won't share about him, but he's just an all-purpose type, wonderful Pillsbury kid, married, got two little girls, and delight to our life. If I ever come back, I'll tell you about him. I got a whole story about him. But I'm going to tell you about a boy named Larry that was 20 years old in 1975. On the 14th of June, on a Friday night, he was graduating from Citrus College up in Glendora. And he was president of the class, president of the choir, scholarship to USC, one to UCLA. He had just returned from a trip to Russia with a Christian singing group. And Dr. Lloyd Ogilvy gave the address that night, and he said, "I'd like to meet this boy's parents, and I hope they have a car with a big trunk to carry home all this glory." So Bill and I went forward and talked to him, and he said, "Your boy has shared with me he's a beautiful Christian, and God's got his hand on his life." And I mean, wouldn't that thrill every mother to have Dr. Ogilvy tell you that God has his hand on your son's life? We were real thrilled and took home all the glory and put it on top of the mantle, all the cups and the awards and the blue ribbons and the scholarship papers. And then the next day was June the 14th, and happened to be the day the big Disneyland the first electric light parade, and also was the bicentennial in 1975. Maybe somebody remember that. And so my sister and her husband, he's a minister and she works for Billy Graham, and they were coming from Hawaii to LA just for one day to be with us, to go down to Disneyland to this big electric light parade and the bicentennial, stay all night at a hotel in Anaheim. The next day we were going to take them to our church. We thought that'd blow them out of the water right there, because that's not the kind of church they're from. And then Father's Day was that Father's Day dinner, and we're going to have Father's Day dinner at Knott's Berry Farm, and then they had to leave to go home. Now this is the first time we had seen them since Tim's death, and so this is a big exciting time, and I had it all planned. I had all bought the tickets for everything, paid for everything, and we had all arranged that we were going to do this big day together. And I didn't know that was going to be the most difficult day of my life, because as I was leaving that day to go to the airport by myself to pick them up to start this whole thing, someone called and wanted to borrow Larry's big red basic youth book, which you probably all have shoved in a drawer. They only fit one size drawer. So I went in his room. He kept his room beautiful, had a Bible study at our home, never gave us any problem, just a delightful boy. And I went in to get the book, and underneath it was a whole stack of homosexual magazines and pictures and literature and letters he had written and letters that had been written to him. It was a whole life of what I didn't understand. And he had just graduated the night before. And first I thought maybe it was a research project, but you know, school was over with. Why would he have this? How could it be? And I got that sick feeling in my stomach. I've just got to get to the airport. I mean, I just can't stay. I mean, I'll just kill him tomorrow. I'll just kill him if he's homosexual. I can't stand it. We can't have this in our family. We have this ministry of helping parents. How could this be? And so I just frantically grabbed up two whole armloads of this stuff, magazines, pictures, literature, tapes, the whole thing, and I threw it in the trunk of my car. I thought last night this car was full of glory in the trunk, and less than 24 hours it's full of garbage. If I had Dr. Ogilvie's number, I'd call him and say, you ought to see what I got in my trunk now. But I just had to get to the airport. I mean, do you ever have to just, you have to do something, and no matter how sick you are, I had to get to the airport. So I left him a note. He was rehearsing at his Christian singing group. I left him a note and said, dear Larry, I love you and God loves you, but I found this stuff. I couldn't even call it anything. I mean, I didn't know what to call this stuff, but I found the stuff and I have it with me, so he won't go looking for it. Have it with me in the trunk of my car. And then I left to go to the airport, sobbing and crying all the way. And all of a sudden, my teeth were itching. I had an elephant standing on my chest. And I felt like I had a shag rug in my throat. And I thought, well, what is this? I mean, I picked up my husband on the highway. I buried two sons and I didn't have this. But just because I have a homosexual child or whatever this means, I mean, I had all these physical symptoms of panic. I got to the airport to pick up my sister and her husband, and she said, oh, you look awful. Well, I did look awful. And I said, oh, it's just something I can't swallow. Can't swallow, that's for sure. And then I thought, I just got to get him in the back seat. I got to scrunch him in the back seat because if I open the trunk, they're going to see all that stuff, and I don't want them to see it. They're nice people, but they're very square. They don't know anything about this. Not that I knew anything, because what did I know? I didn't know anything either. But all of a sudden, when I went to pick up her luggage, she had two pieces of purple luggage. Now, my dad was a minister, but somewhere in my training, I thought that lesbians wore purple and liked purple. It's not true. So for all of you here that have purple, that doesn't have any significance. But I thought, lesbians wear purple. My sister's got purple. My sister, who works for Billy Graham, has been married to a minister. My sister's a lesbian. And here I'm at the Los Angeles airport, and I'm thinking, my sister's a lesbian. And I got this pain in my chest. My teeth are itching. And then I'm thinking, oh, I don't want to open the trunk, because if I open the trunk, they're going to see all that stuff. I just had thrown it in the trunk. I didn't even cover it with anything. And I'll just scrunch them in the back seat. And then my brother-in-law said, and we brought you a crate of pineapple. Oh, a crate of pineapple. Now how am I going to get them in the back seat and get the pineapple in the back seat? And then they were putting with these sickening sweet Lays. You know, they people bring these Lays. They smell like a funeral anyway. And so here they're putting the Lays on me. And they got you get the picture. It was awful. And so somehow we were driving from the LA airport over to Anaheim where we were going to spend the night. And it looked to me like my own sister, you know, is a lesbian. And my son, 20-year-old, is a homosexual. The whole world, suddenly, the curtain went up and everybody was homosexual. And then my brother-in-law would point out the Angel Stadium. And, oh, they're all homosexual there, too. And then he'd point out Shuler's Church, and oh, they're all homosexual too. It just looked like the whole world suddenly had become homosexual, just because I had found these magazines in my car. So we got to the hotel, and they were gonna change clothes and go across the street, and we're all gonna meet at the flagpole. The plan was we're all gonna meet at the flagpole, and then we're gonna do Disneyland and then go to the hotel. So as you went in the Disneyland thing that night, as you go through the turnstile, instead of giving you those little A, B, C, D, E, those little dumb coupons, they didn't do that, but they gave you a little band to put on your head, and it said, I'm a Yankee Doodle Dandy. And it had a feather in it. Maybe some of you remember June the 14th of 1975. There's 50 million people there, I'm sure. And we all had feathers. And there's little bands. You had to put the band on because that was your ticket to get in. You had to have it on. So here, I put the band on, put the feather on. And we get to the flagpole where we're supposed to meet and do Disneyland. Well, my husband had gotten there ahead of us, and he went off to buy popcorn. Always off buying popcorn in every crisis of our life. And when he dies, I tell him on his tombstone, we're going to put, Bill is not here, he's out buying popcorn. So he was buying popcorn. My sister and her husband greeted Larry. They hadn't seen him since Tim's funeral, so they greeted him. We're real glad to see him. But I had just seen him that morning, and I couldn't throw up or anything. You know, I had just seen him in the morning. And here were these great big 30-feet chickens, all electric chickens, all coming down here. And just about then, the Tinkerbell Fairy sailed across the sky, see? Oh, Tinkerbell Fairy. See, it's all over. I mean, everything. And it was so hot and so crowded, and these big electric chickens coming. Now, if you know the Disneyland dimensions, the flagpole is here, Lost Children's here, Mr. Lincoln's here, and the big chickens are coming here. And so crowded and so hot, I think we'll just go see Mr. Lincoln and skip the parade. Oh, good, I'll get rid of her. So she and her husband went to see Mr. Lincoln. The husband's still getting the popcorn. My son and I are standing at the flagpole. He and I and a million people with these feathers in their hats. And so he looked at me and he said, I'm homosexual, or maybe I'm bisexual. Bisexual. I'm homosexual. I knew from the Bible, but bisexual, I never heard of. That sounds like sex twice a month. Why did he say that? So as I'm standing there, and he's telling me maybe he's bisexual, a lady had a fat kid in a stroller, and she rolled over my foot in the That's not funny. You people laugh so easy. And so the projection from the stroller cut into my leg, and I started to bleed. And I looked down, and I saw blood coming, and I thought, oh, how euphoric, how wonderful God is. I'm going to bleed to death right here. Right here at the Lost Children sign. And I just had a vision of Barbara Johnson died here at the flagpole. How wonderful. I don't have to kill him tomorrow. Or I don't have to kill myself because I'm just going to hemorrhage and bleed to death. And I'm just going to be out of the whole pain and the whole thing. And then suddenly I thought, but my trunk is full of all those magazines. And if anybody finds them, they'll think they're mine. So that one thought was enough to pull me together that I can't hemorrhage until I get out and clean out the trunk and get that stuff out of there. And he said he was sick and he wanted to go home. Oh, you're sick. I want to die. But he said he wanted to go home. I said, okay, you better go home. I'm ready to kill him anyway. So he went home, and we went and saw Disneyland. My husband finally finished popcorn. We all were together. We're going back to the hotel that night, and we're going to stay there all night. Now, I don't know if you've ever cried all night and sobbed in a pillow, but that's what I did. My sister and husband, they went to bed. They were tired from the Hawaii trip, and my husband finished popcorn. He was tired. And so I sobbed in the pillow. I choked and I travailed and I sobbed. I made terrible sounds. I mean, sounds came out of me like a bull. I mean, I never heard such kind of sounds that came out of me. But I was just, and at 4:30 in the morning, after crying all night, Father's Day morning, I finally was choking and gagging. I thought I was having a heart attack. And here I'm in Anaheim, and I lived in Covina then. And so finally, my husband woke up, 4:30, he said, well, what's the matter with you? You acted kind of strange last night. Well, I'm glad you noticed. The most horrible night of my life. And here it's Father's Day morning. What a time, 4:30, you have to tell him about this. But he said, I want to know what's the matter with you. So I said, well, I just found out last night that Larry's homosexual. Well, he sat up in bed at that. And then I said, or maybe he's even a bisexual. Bisexual. I mean, bisexual, he didn't know what that was. He's been lieutenant commander of the Navy, but what did he know about that? He didn't know anything. We used to sing that song, Don, we now are gay apparel, you know. That's all we knew. The word gay wasn't even in focus then, so he got up out of bed, and here we're 30 miles from home, and he's putting on his clothes, zipping up his pants like he's going somewhere. I said, where are you going? 4:30 on Father's Day morning. Well, I'm going home to fix him. He's going home to fix him. And I said, I'll just be dead when you come back. I'll just be dead. Because here I'm gasping and choking and trying to think, you call 911 or 411. What number do you call when you're dying? So he putted off his little Carmen gear and went home to Covina to fix this kid. And meanwhile, my sister heard the walls are thin in those cheap hotels that Travelodge, you know, and so she heard the noise and heard the little car putting off. So she came knocking at the door. What's the matter? Did you and Bill have a fight? Oh, no, he always goes home to shave, you know. So Nora's going to have to tell her something. She said, oh, I said, if it's only a fight, I could handle a fight. I mean, anybody can handle a marriage fight if you've been married 40 years, but how are you going to handle that? And so I said, I went out to the car, I grabbed a whole armful of magazines, and I threw them on the bed, and I said, your nephew, not my son, but your nephew is a homosexual. Well, he can't be. He's a Christian. That's what she said. He can't be. He's a Christian. I said, well, that's what I thought he can't be. Now, her dad's a preacher. My dad, too. We had the same dad. But anyway, she didn't know anything about this. And the most anything pornographic we had ever seen was, if you look through a Mysterious and Robot catalog and you saw men's underwear, that's about as much as I'd ever had seen. And she hadn't seen anything else. So here we are looking at this stuff, 4:30 in the morning. And her husband, he's a preacher, he heard the noise, and he came in to see what we were doing, looking at all this stuff. And ordinarily, he has real straight hair, but as he stood there and we looked at this stuff, actually, I remember his hair is getting curly, looking at all this stuff. And here we are, a preacher and two preacher's kids, standing there on Father's Day morning, looking at all this stuff, trying to, well, how could this be? Why could he have this? He didn't understand it. My husband went home and came back in 2 hours, and he said, there's nothing wrong with him, it's just a phase. You're making too much of it. It's just a phase. All kids go through a phase. It's just a phase. I wanted to believe that. Somehow we went to church and we went to dinner at Knott's Berry Farm. Can you imagine trying to eat dinner at Knott's Berry Farm? Father's Day dinner at Knott's Berry Farm. And I couldn't eat. I was crying. My sister was crying. My brother-in-law with curly hair. And my husband, we just passed the food, letting him have it all because we just couldn't eat. We're so upset. So they left and went back to Minnesota because they thought in their little white wonderful world there, they don't have little ivory soap people. They don't have any problems in Minnesota. It's all in California anyway. The next day I went down to Anaheim to a hotline center. I knew there was a hotline there and I went in. I said, I just found out my son's homosexual and I want to talk to a mother. And they said, oh, we don't have any mothers. And where are they? All in the home for the bewildered or something? I want to talk to a mother who can tell me I'm going to get through this. A mother put their arm around me and tell me I'm going to get rid of this pain in my chest and my teeth are going to quit itching. I'm going to be normal again. I said, no, we don't have any mothers. We just have two ex-homosexuals. Ooh, I don't talk to them. And that's why I'm here, because I have one of those. I don't want to talk to that. So I slammed the door and I went home and I thought, oh Lord, if you ever get me through this and I don't end up in the home for the bewildered myself, I'll start a group for mothers. I'll start some of the group for mothers to help parents that are going through this. Of course, I thought I was going to die anyway, and you promise God everything when you think you're going to die. So I got home, and this boy who had lived in that home 20 years, beautiful Christian boy, and happily never gave us any problems, just nothing but a delight to us. He disappeared. He was gone. Nothing was left in his room. He took everything. I'd only been gone an hour and a half, and he was gone. I called Bill and I said, well, he's gone. He had a little red Volkswagen that was in my name, but he's just gone. Didn't leave a note or anything. He'll be home. Where would he go? 20 years old. He worked at In-N-Out Hamburgers, tithed his money, had a scholarship to USC. Well, I don't know where he would go because we lived in our nice Christian world. We had all his Christian friends. He dated a lot of girls from our church and there's no indication there was any problem. But he was gone, and I waited a few days. We didn't hear from him. He didn't call. There's no way to contact him. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Do you call the police and tell them your son disappeared with your car because it was in my name? Or do you call the department? I didn't want to get involved with the Department of Motor Vehicles. But do you call the DMV and tell them that the car is gone? Or do you cancel your credit cards because he had one of my credit cards? He could go to Jamaica on my credit card. But, I mean, what do you do? And so I wasn't getting any help. I used to call my sister a lot, and I got a $600 phone bill, and I can't be calling her. I have to get some help. So I started writing to people who are supposed to know. I started with Billy Graham and all the top Christian leaders. What do you do when you have a 20-year-old son who disappears into the gay lifestyle? Well, the letters I got back were so funny. One of them said it's a sin. One said it's a spirit. One said it was a demon. One said I should send my son shorts to Texas to be prayed for. I didn't know where my son was. I sure didn't know how his shorts were. And then another Christian leader wrote and told me that the Antichrist is going to be homosexual. Well, that's real encouraging. That's just what I needed to know, that the Antichrist is going to be homosexual. And then they sent me little vials of oil. I had a lot of people send me little vials of oil. I mean, what am I supposed to do with this oil? I had enough oil to grease a car. But, I mean, is it for me to put on myself, or do I drink it, or what do I do with all this oil? And so I wasn't getting any help. I couldn't stand to go to the store shopping, because if I went in a store and I saw homogenized milk, I think, homosexual milk, see? I just couldn't stand to be with anybody. I didn't want to go anywhere. And, of course, I didn't cook. My husband just ate popcorn, and my son worked at Taco Bell. And so I lost 40 pounds, which I subsequently gained. But, you see, I'm really a perfect 10 under here. I just keep it covered with fat so it won't get scratched. And so during those next few months, we didn't hear from him. I stayed home. I couldn't cook. I didn't eat. I just stayed in the bedroom. I wanted to die. I just wanted to die. I stayed there and counted the roses on the wallpaper. And I thought God really had forsaken me. And people were saying to Bill, oh, poor Barbara, she hasn't recovered from the death of her two sons. Well, it wasn't the death of those two sons. They were in heaven. They were deposits in heaven. I could say, praise the Lord, I got two deposits in heaven. But I couldn't tell anybody about this other boy that was out there in the gay life. See, we know now that openness is to wholeness, as secrets are to sickness. And if you keep this big abscess inside, you don't let it out and don't drain it, you're going to get sick. And I was getting sick. I was really sick. My husband made me go see a psychologist, Christian psychologist. I got dressed once a week and went in to see him. He told me how depressed I was. I knew I was depressed. And it cost $50 for him to tell me I was depressed. And so finally, after 11 months had gone by, he said, if he's been gone this long and he's never come home, very possibly he never will come home again because he's adjusted to the gay life and he's found support there. Never come home. This beautiful 20-year-old boy who was the light of all, never come home. I couldn't believe that. So I went back home that day, and he called my husband, and he said, Barbara is so depressed, I'm afraid she's suicidal. I think we're going to have her see about having her put in Parkside West, which is the Looney Tunes where I live. That's where you go and make baskets and stuff. And so my husband said, now he's Swedish and he's very tight, frugal, that's the word, frugal. And he said, well, she's not vicious or anything, but if it doesn't cost any money and my insurance pays, she can go there, but otherwise she can stay home because she's not hurting anybody. That's what he said. So here my option is, I got two options. I mean, if his insurance pays, I get to go make baskets with these loony people. And if his insurance doesn't pay, then I stay home and count the roses in the wallpaper. I mean, what kind of option is that? So I got in the car, and I thought, I'm just going to kill myself. I'm just going to find the highest place I can find, and I'm just going to go over the cliff. And the highest place I could find was up on Harbor Boulevard before you get to Disneyland. There's a high cliff. And I thought, well, I'll just drive over that high cliff, and I'll just kill myself. But then I thought, well, what if I'm just maimed, and then I'm making baskets, and I'm all crippled up and everything? And my insurance might not pay if I'm just maimed. And that's when I said, Lord, here I am a Christian. My dad is a minister. I went to Christian schools. I tried to serve you. And here I want to kill myself. And I said, I can't stand to live with this pain anymore. I can't live with this fracture. I'm so fractured. I'm not a wife. I'm not a mother. I'm a zero with a rim rubbed out. I don't think I'm even a Christian. I don't know what I believe anymore. I don't want to sing. I don't want to go to church. I just want to die. And I said, I've got to the point where I'm going to say, whatever, Lord, whatever you do, I mean, if you take his life, if he never comes home again, if I never see him again, whatever, instead of why me, why my family, why my kids, I just completely said, whatever, Lord, and I took a hammer out of my imagination, and I nailed that kid to the cross, and I said, whatever you do with his life, I'm nailing him down. Before I thought I gave him to you, but I would pick him up again. This time I'm depositing with you, and I'm nailing him down, and whatever you do, and when I said whatever, it was like a million little sparkles right here came up, and that elephant came off my chest for the first time in 11 months. That shag rug came out of my mouth, and my teeth quit itching. I whirled that car around home, and I thought, wow, you're not going to hardly wait to get home and tell my husband what happened. Now, he's trying to get me in the home, you know. And so I called him, and I said, oh, the most wonderful thing has happened. He said, what happened? Where are you? I said, well, I'm home. Well, where have you been? And I was talking real fast. I said, I went down to Anaheim. I was going to kill myself. And I figured it might be me. It would be me. And so I nailed him to the cross. And he said, what? And I think he thought, oh, I should have put her in yesterday. I waited too long. And so he said, just stay there. Don't go anywhere. And I'm coming home. Now, he's the one that had brain damage. Didn't know anybody for 2 years, you know. So I sat there, he came pedaling home, and he said, now sit down and tell me what happened. You were a zombie when I left this morning. What happened? And I tried to tell him slow and not get excited, but I went down, and I said, I nailed him to the cross. He thought there was some kid on the 57 freeway, you know. And I said, whatever, Lord. And I nailed him down, I gave him to God, and I tried to explain to him that I relinquished him to God. I said, whatever you do in his life. After I went through the whole thing, he sat there and he said, well, I'm sure glad you're feeling better because my insurance didn't cover you anyway. And so the next day I was cleaning. I had a lot of cleaning to do. These great big cleaning bags because, you know, nobody had, he'd eaten popcorn and my other kid ate a Taco Bell. Nobody did any work. So I'm cleaning up all this stuff and I'm singing. I had the music on and God just really rejuvenated me. And the telephone rang and it was this son that we hadn't heard from. And he said, I want to come home and bring you a hamburger. I want to talk to you. So I thought, well, that was fine. I was excited. So he came in and we sat and talked and he didn't say what he was doing. Didn't say he wasn't involved with anybody, living by himself, going to UCLA. So that sounded good. And we just talked about surface things and he started coming home every weekend talking to his dad and his brother over the next few months and everything looked like it was fine because we didn't ask too many questions. It was just sort of a surface relationship. Then my younger boy was married that next year, and so Larry was best man at the wedding, and then he graduated from UCLA with a lot of honors, and we went to his graduation, so it looked like our life had smoothed out. I didn't want to hear about homosexuality, I didn't want to talk about it, because I thought, well, we came through it, and we've survived. And then I was asked to write that book, Where Does a Mother Go to Resign? So I said to him, how would it be, how do you think of it if I wrote the book telling about Bill's accident and the two boys that were killed, and about your disappearance and your coming home? He said, well, he didn't care if I did. He didn't think I could anyway, and I never wrote anything in my life before. I hardly passed English in school. And so he said, fine, it was all right with him. Well, I sat down to write that book, and in 8 weeks it just poured out of me. See, the publisher said the Holy Spirit would propel. I said, well, they sure have to, because I couldn't, because I've never written anything in my life. But anyway, the book came out in 8 weeks' time. And it got put on all the bookshelves, and so he called me one day, and he said, how do you think I feel when I go to the Piggly Wiggly Market, and I go to the airport, and there's that book? I said, well, I mean, you said I could write it. He said, well, I really didn't think you would. I didn't think you could. And he said, I don't like it, and I want to tell you that I've got someone in my life that I'm living with, and I'm going to go full bore into the gay life, and I never want to see my family again. I'm disowning you. I'm going to change my name, and I'm never coming home again. Now, this was just 2 years after I said, whatever, Lord. So, wow, I didn't really think, I didn't mean that. But that's what he said. So I said to him on the phone, well, I love you, and it's my job to love you and pray for you. And I'm going to do two things for you until they put the casket on my head and put a lily in my hand. I'm going to love you, and I'm going to pray for you. Because, see, I want God's best for you, and I don't think homosexuality is God's best for anybody. I didn't understand much about it then, but I just said, I love you, and you're a Christian, and God only gives one kind of life, and that's eternal life, and that I'm giving you to him, and I've given you to him 2 years ago, and I had, but boy, did that hurt to have him do that. And he did. He changed his name. We got some paper that he disowned us. That's real rejection when your kid disowns you. But for the next 7 years, I was out speaking to groups like this. Maybe some of you heard me before. I did Dobson's show when I was going through all this, saying that he had disowned us, changed his name, told us he was in love with somebody, and that he wasn't going to see us anymore, going full bore into the gay life. And so I was going out telling parents there is hope, that God will go after the children of the righteous. There is hope. But I didn't see anything happen. Nothing was happening. And so here I'm telling these parents that there is hope, but in my heart it seemed hollow, because how come it didn't happen to me? And then 2 years ago, just before Mother's Day, I was getting ready to go to Minnesota to speak, and this boy who we had not heard from in several years, didn't know anything about him, where he was, or anything, he called and said, I want to come and bring you a Mother's Day present. Now, you know what I thought? I bet he's going to tell me he's going to marry this guy. And why else would he want to come home? I haven't seen him all these years. Now he wants to come home and bring me a Mother's Day present. But that's what he said. And so I thought, well, I was always open for a present. So I said, okay, you can come home. You can come home. So he came home, walked in, didn't even have a present. See, I thought, see, you don't even have me a present after all this. But he walked in, and he sat down, big tears in his eyes, and he said, I want you to forgive me for all the years of pain that I've caused you, because last week I went to an advanced seminar, Basic Youth, and I went forward and rededicated my life to the Lord, and I took all the evidence of the old life, everything, the books, the tapes, the literature, the whole thing, to a fireplace, and I burned them. And while it was burning, I felt this complete sense of release. For the first time in 11 years, it's been 11 years since we first found out about this, first time in 11 years, I feel complete release that this thing isn't containing me anymore, that I'm right with God, and the first time I'm right with God in 11 years. And the boy that he lives with, if you saw him, you'd know him, because he's real big on television. He's in seven Brides for Seven Brothers pictures and several ads for television commercials. He said he went forward the next day. His mother had committed suicide when she found out he was gay. His father had had a stroke. He didn't have any family. But he went forward and accepted the Lord the next day. Now, this was 11 years of pain and suffering we had been through, you see, and when this happened. And at first, I didn't want to go on a lot of programs and tell it, because I thought, I'm not a woman of a lot of faith. I have a lot of joy, but not a lot of faith. And what if I go tell that, and then he slips back and gets into problems again? So at first I was a little hesitant to share on any big network programs. But now almost 2.5 years have gone by, and he's active in his church. He loves his church. He's serving the Lord. He's living a life clean before the Lord. Now, we can't put people in a box. We can't put God in a box and say he's got to be healed in a certain way, and until he's married and got kids, he's not healed. I don't believe that. I believe that he's right with the Lord, and that's what I've always prayed for him, that his life would be hid with Christ, and that's what he's done. And so God has done that for him. Now, I have just about 2 minutes left, and I want to share something. I've got to give you a verse. You wouldn't think I'm a Christian up here. I haven't given you a verse. I like Philippians 4:8. Finally, my brethren, whatsoever things are true and whatsoever things are perfect and lovely. You look it up. You know the verse. Think on these things, and the God of peace will be with you. Now, when I go out and tell this story over and over through the years and tell it, and as I tell about Stephen lying there in that box, all brown and discolored, my mind, I said, Lord, give me a windshield wiper mind that I can talk about it and tell it over and over and not see that same and smell that whole cemetery place. Help me to do that. And give me a frozen picture of Stephen so that when I tell it, I can windshield wipe that picture and tell the women about it, but in my mind I can switch it off and think of something happy about him, thinking on things that are good and pure and lovely. So God gave me a frozen picture of him, and it was so neat. I want to share it with you. When he was 17, he came home from school one day, and a girl had made him, crocheted him, a beautiful green sweater, a real puffy green sweater, and he was so thrilled. And he came home and was showing off this sweater and how thrilled it was. And then the next day he came home and he spilled cocoa all over it. He said, "Oh, I ruined my sweater, I ruined my sweater." And I said, "Oh, don't worry, Stephen, I'll wash it for you." "Don't you wash it, you might shrink it. Don't you touch my sweater," you know, gave me all these instructions. And as soon as he went to school, I did what any of you would have done. I washed the sweater. And it came out beautiful, nice, fat, puffy green sweater, and I put it in his drawer, and it's beautiful. But that day I was down at a Barbie and Ken doll toy store, and I found this little green sweater. And it's the same color as his sweater, the same color as the sweater, has a little ribbing at the top and a little ribbing at the bottom, and I said, "I've got to have that sweater." So I bought it, and I brought it home, and I laid it on his bed like that. Now, when he came in from school, he took one look at the sweater and said, "Oh, my sweater, you boiled my sweater." He said, "It looks like a coaster." And he went on and ripped away at me about how awful I was that I ruined his sweater. And, oh, he just exhausted himself. And after he got done exhausting himself on how terrible I was that I had washed his sweater, I said, "Oh, Stephen, look in the drawer." And so he opened his shift robe, and here was his nice, fat, puffy green sweater. Well, he was so humiliated because first he said, "Well, I knew you wouldn't hurt it." Well, he thought I had. And he had that cute, crooked smile, and he put his arm around me and says, "You know, I knew you wouldn't hurt my sweater." And so I say, "Thank you, Lord, for that memory. See, today's experiences are tomorrow's memories. And I'm thankful for that frozen picture of him with that cute, crooked smile, and he's telling me he knows I wouldn't hurt his sweater." And so when I talk about him, and I do it hundreds of times over the year, I tell you what I did. But I'm not seeing that. I'm seeing that smiling boy with a crooked smile. And as far as Tim goes, I had a little father, because he was not a real bubbly, happy kid either. I didn't want to think about the mortuary in Rose Hills and all that. And so I said, "Give me a memory of Tim." And I remembered one time when I came home and all the four boys were in the kitchen. And we had a white wall in our kitchen, a white brick wall. And they were sitting there with a big bowl of red Jell-O, raspberry Jell-O with bananas in it. And they had big spoons. And they were just sitting there in the kitchen shrieking with laughter. And they were shooting that Jell-O on the wall. And they were just letting it run down, you know. And the bananas were catching on the bricks and turning brown. And as I heard them shrieking and laughing in the kitchen, I thought, whatever could be so funny? And he was the ringleader. He thought this was the greatest thing in the world, to shoot all this Jell-O. And they're going to clean it up anyway, so why should I let it go to waste? So I went in and sat down next to him, and I picked up a teaspoon. That's all that was available. I picked up a teaspoon, and I started to shoot the Jell-O. Well, he was so glad that I was going to shoot the Jell-O instead of him, I think. So he reached over and gave me a great big scoop. I mean, why should I have a teaspoon when they had big scoops? So he gave me a big scoop, and we sat there, and we shot and flicked Jell-O on the whole wall. So we had a red wall in the kitchen, and they were going to clean it up. And I say, "Thank you for that memory. Thank you, Lord, that I have the memory, from the memories that I have, that I'm able to share my story." And you know, what really thrills me the most is after I go through my whole story like this, people will come up to me and say, "Wow, after I heard your story, I don't have any problems at all." See, God's taken all the pain and all the misery, and because I've been through sorrow, I have joy. And until you've known what sorrow is, you can't know what joy is. So I hope today you've laughed a lot, and we've been able to infuse you with joy. You laughed a lot, and some of you cried a lot, and that's good. And I appreciate being able to be here. It's been my joy and my pleasure. Thank you.
This is the end of this message and the end of this cassette. If you would like more information concerning Chapel Tapes, please contact Chapel Tapes, P.O. Box 8000, Costa Mesa, California, 92628.